We'll call the House Committee on Community and Regional Affairs to order. Time is 1:13 p.m. Tuesday, February 20. And members present are myself, Representative Zosterman, Representative Elton, and Representative Kopp. We've got two bills before us on the agenda. The first bill is House Bill 401, Revenue Bonds and Water Sewer. The next bill to be addressed following that is House Bill 400, Welfare Reform. The first bill to take up is House Bill 401, Revenue Bonds for Water Sewer. In your packets is a copy of the bill. As a bill summary, sectional analysis, zero fiscal notes from DEC and Revenue, and various backup material. And today presenting the bill on behalf of the administration is Keith Elton, Director of Facility and Construction and Operations from DEC. And on teleconference today, we have online Anchorage, Bethel, Dillingham, Delta Junction, Fairbanks, Glen Allen, Kenai, Kodiak, Nome, and Unalaska. With that, I'd like to welcome Keith Elton to come forward and present the bill to us today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Keith Elton. I'm with the Department of Environmental Conservation. I'm here today to explain House Bill 401 and its companion in the Senate, Senate Bill 207. A little background on this program before I go into the specifics of the bill will probably help you understand what we're doing. The Environmental Protection Agency, back in 1987, when the Clean Water Act was reauthorized, was mandated to drop their construction grants program and shift it into a low-interest loan program for the construction of wastewater facilities. That also can apply to solid waste facilities where you're treating the groundwater contaminants that might be present, estuarine contamination, and non-point source pollution control. Since 1989, the department has administered the Alaska Clean Water Fund, which is a program set up to make those low-interest loans. These loans are available to incorporated communities that have a dedicated revenue stream that can repay the loans. There are 20-year loans, and the interest rate fluctuates with the municipal bond index, and typically it's between 4 and 5%. Right now, they're about 3.75%. So they're fairly attractive financing alternative to general fund grants as grants diminish. To date, we've received about $80 million between a combination of the state and federal dollars go into this fund. Until the last 2 years, the demand for these funds has been less than the availability of the funds, so we've had more money than we've had demand for. However, the last 2 years, that trend has started to reverse, primarily with state revenues declining and general fund grants becoming less available. So we were looking for an alternative to expand the use of the Clean Water Fund. The Clean Water Fund, at the current rate of obligation, will be totally used up, except for the revolving portion of it that's coming back in 2 years. So we looked at what other states are doing. There's about 21 other states that also administer this program through what they call a leveraged program. They use the corpus of the fund and sell revenue bonds using the corpus as collateral to leverage the account into more dollars. So we sat down and worked with the Department of Law, Bond Council, and Department of Revenue to come up with a process to fit Alaska's needs. And with your indulgence, I'd like to go through this chart, which maybe I could ask you to move a second. Just I think I'll explain what we are really doing. To just look at the top half of this chart first, this describes the program that we currently have in place. The Alaska Clean Water Fund, which has capitalized
80% by federal dollar, 20% by state, coming into take the Blue Center portion as representing today's pot of $80 million. Of that $80 million, approximately $50 million has been loaned to 24 recipients. In your package, you will find a list of the communities that currently have received loans. They range from everywhere from Kachemak City up to the city of Anchorage. As I said, all it requires is you have to be incorporated and you have to have a dedicated revenue stream. So if we take the money, make loans to the municipal projects, repayment stream comes back to recycle into the program. And I said, this is what's in place right now. The $30 million that's left will be gone in about 2 years unless we do something to leverage that $30 million. So the proposed legislation you have in front of you sets up a bond redemption fund, which will then pay the bond issuance costs to the state bond committee, who will then issue bonds, investors will buy the bonds, bond proceeds come back up into a bigger Alaska Clean Water Fund, and it recycles back up to projects. The repayment stream comes back through the bond redemption fund and pays off the bonds and keeps on cycling. So we've got a possibility of taking that $30 million into a much larger number in doing more projects statewide. And as I said, this is going to, it's not restricted to any community, but by virtue of the fact that it does require a dedicated payment stream coming back, is primarily a benefit to the larger incorporated communities. You'll see Anchorage has got a big share of the projects, but so does some of the smaller places, Cordova, Seward, Homer, Craig, Juneau. I don't believe Fairbanks has got any, but there's a list of them in your packet. So the whole purpose of this bill is just to provide another funding alternative as state revenues decline and make it grants more limited.
Keith, can I interrupt for a question there? Your $50 million that you have out in loans and are going to be repaid, I guess, when does that cycle back in so that there's not a need to go out and buy more bonds? Someplace there's got to be a cycle here that completes itself.
All the repayment stream, as well as any additional federal capitalization, is dedicated back to paying the bonds off. So everything, the $50 million that's already out there is a big incentive to the bond buying market, since we've already got that repayment stream dedicated coming back. So that, in addition to the $30 million that's currently unobligated, will provide the corpus to this fund.
I think you lost me for a second there. So are you, well, I guess I'll maybe back up then. Are you saying the total $80 million of the original is going to be your corpus?
Let me see if I can say this so we can both understand it. There's $30 million that is sitting there that actually will be the main collateral. However, there is money that's coming back from the original $50 million that has been loaned to communities. That repayment stream with interest comes back as well and provides assurance to the bond buyers that the state has the ability to pay back those bonds.
How big of bonds are you talking about? I mean, I'm curious as to where the $50 million is going to go when it's paid back.
Oh, it will go to new projects. It will continue to recycle. Once it comes in, this is one of the questions that the Senate committee had as well. We're working on two amendments right now, and they're a Senate CRA committee, which will provide the cap that you're talking about. The language has not been approved yet in the Senate CRA committee, but we're expecting it to be heard tomorrow. And one of the proposals is that they would establish a $15 million per year cap on the amount of revenue bonds that could be sold, and up to $100 million total. This would allow a finite
maximums the state would be able to go in debt on, even though this particular proposal does not require the full faith and credit of the state. This is their revenue bonds, and basically the communities are the ones who are establishing their full faith and credit.
Representative Cott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you explain the process as it is today without this legislation? You've lost me a little bit. We've got some federal capitalization grant money. We've got some matching state money. And that pool, which makes up the Alaska Clean Water Fund, is then leveraged or granted to municipalities at the present time with no strings attached, or is there a repayment?
Okay.
Is it a loan?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cott, we're only talking loans. The program as it currently exists provides low interest loans from the $80 million combination of state and federal dollars. Those funds, as they come back as repayments in principal and interest, are then again available for reloaning currently. All we're doing is establishing a larger pot of money through the sale of revenue bonds. The administration of the program will proceed exactly as it did before. The loans will go out to communities for eligible projects and be recycled with payment, principal and interest as it comes back.
So, Mr. Chairman, as this fund then is depleted, aren't there monies coming back in municipalities and other areas?
If the money...
Would keep that pool of money at least the present level?
we definitely expect it will revolve. The level will be somewhat dependent on how many bonds are sold. And we can't quite predict that, but we do expect it will stabilize and be a revolving loan fund at a point in time where we will have a fund that would probably be in the neighborhood of $10 to $15 million a year.
Are you, Representative Elton?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Let me see if I can restate this in a way that helps me understand. At the present time, we have a loan fund that's capitalized with about $80 million. $50 million of that is already out in loans to municipalities, leaving $30 million yet to be allocated.
Right.
If under this bonding proposal, and if we accept the caps that are being discussed on the other side, you would have the authority over a period of time to build up your loan fund from the $80 million that you have now to $180 million at some point in the future, assuming that the caps that are being discussed on the other side are imposed. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So that you'd have a revolving loan fund that's partially capitalized with federal dollars, state dollars, bond dollars, and the pool is $180 million instead of $80
million. That's correct.
Thank you. Representative Osterman?
One momentary addition to that. We do expect that the reauthorization of the Clean Water Act, which is up again, will include additional federal appropriations into this. So with a state match, it could ultimately grow above that level.
Representative Osterman?
What do you see as the dollar need? If in the last few years you've been able to keep the $30 million in there and not have to spend it, but now you say that there's becoming more of demand. At some point in time, the revolving aspect of this thing where the $50 million comes back in and is reloaned is an ongoing process. So I'm wondering just what kind of a dollar figure you really need out there. Do you need more than $80 million if it's on a revolving loan? It should be there all the time to reloan.
Through the chair to Representative Osterman. We will be limited to the repayment stream for additional loans once the first amount is out there. So if they're repaying it on a 20-year cycle, we would only be getting back about 1/20th of that in any given year. So we would not have $80 million available after the money is currently cycled once or until it starts coming back.
I guess back to my original question, what was the cycle time on this? Are you talking 20-year loans?
They are 20-year loans. In your packet, you will also find a list of the in addition to the list of projects that where money has been loaned, there is a list of communities who have expressed an interest in receiving these loans. That list right now is about $78 million. There is no certainty or an obligation on their part that they would ever need to apply for those loans, but that's an expression of interest at this date. We do this on an annual basis. Some of these projects will get grants, some of them will fall by the wayside for other reasons, but they're at the current rate, which is $13 million a year, we will be out of that corpus of $30 million within a two-year period. So we're trying to expand our capability of providing loan funds to communities while we still have this corpus available. Once this corpus is loaned, we no longer have the collateral available to sell these revenue bonds. So passage of this legislation this year will enhance the ability of this legislation to be effective. Because the smaller that gets, the less leveraging we'll have available.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I've got some questions that I'll be asking you. I'd like to give you an opportunity to complete your comments, if we may. And I do have some questions to ask of you.
Well, I believe, Mr. Chairman, that we're into the questions now, so we might as well continue. The comments are pretty much concluded.
Representatives, is there any questions available? If not, okay, there's two situations here as far as my understanding is concerned. Currently, the Village Safe Water makes grants to rural water sewer projects, and this program is geared toward those communities you mentioned, build-up communities like Anchorage that have the paying back ability through property taxes or revenue stream that they had previous. Will this free up funds for the water sewer project, especially the Safe Water program that I mentioned that funds the rural areas of the state that don't have the payback capability?
Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't presume to guess how the monies might be appropriated by the legislature, but it certainly has the potential if part of the capital budget demand is assumed by the loan program to the larger communities that have a repayment stream, that certainly would have the effect of making additional limited dollars in the capital budget available to other communities. However, the legislature chose to make that allocation, it is entirely possible.
Thank you. Also, we have the 50-50 municipal matching grant. Will it free up funds from the municipal matching grants as they are today, as they're funded currently? The communities are provided that. For example, I believe the average is $25,000 per community to for community use as a matching grant toward community projects. Will this again free up funds?
Mr. Chairman, I think I may be somewhat confused. Are you talking about the governor's matching grants program or DEC's
yes,
matching grants
program?
Yes, the
current capital matching grant program.
I think, Mr. Chairman, that the best way would be to use these two programs in conjunction with each other, that this would provide ability to increase the amount of dollars available to local projects. If they were short of money after receiving their matching grant, they would certainly be eligible to borrow the balance from the loan program. I think the main price it saves is in the governor's or in the capital budget that's approved in addition outside of the matching grants program.
You also mentioned Estuary conservation?
Well, estuary pollution control or correction.
How it applies to this fund?
It is eligible. We have never received an application for estuary enhancement, but it's written into the federal law that it is an eligible application, so we are mandated to repeat that in the state statute.
Now the question is, the reference is made to state agencies to apply for loans. Are state agencies authorized to apply for loans?
Mr. Chairman, the federal language does authorize state agencies to apply for a loan or to be eligible for a loan. This is one of the items that the Senate CRA committee also questioned, and as a result of their work, there is an amendment that will be prepared and heard tomorrow that will redefine that to eliminate state agencies.
Okay. I have one last question. It's referring to the proposed bill before us. The term liberally construed is used on page 7. Line 20.
And it's also on page 8.
What's the meaning of this phrase?
Mr. Chairman, do you mind if I bring somebody from the Attorney General's office up to discuss that?
Sure, please.
Their language, and I'm sure Marie Sansone is much better qualified than I am to discuss it.
Mr. Chairman, this is a standard.
Would
term.
You please identify yourself for the record, please?
Yes, my name is Marie Sansone. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Juneau office. In the term liberal construction, in terms of statutory construction, means that the statute should be broadly construed to give effect to its beneficial purposes of providing money for the public wastewater projects and other pollution control projects. So it's a fairly standard term that's used in interpreting statutes. And it would make a difference would be that if a controversy came up or an issue and a term or provision in the statute couldn't decide which way to interpret it, if it's to be liberally or broadly construed, you construe it in favor of the purpose of the bill of providing funding for these projects. And that would be contrasted with strict construction or narrow construction, where you would have a much more restrictive view of the words, the length of the statute.
Thank you. You have other questions from the committee? Representative Cott.
Mr. Chairman, would under this proposal, would the underground storage tanks fall within the scope?
Representative Cott, the only way that I think it would have fallen under that would have been if we were still going to be making loans to state agencies. Some states have dedicated this program to that purpose. If the state agency stayed in there, it is a potential possibility that we could have made a loan to, say, another part of DEC, who would then clean up an underground storage tank contamination problem and assess the responsible party for that cleanup and recover loans back through that into this program. I do not think the way we're potentially going to change it from the Senate side that that's a possibility. I think that for primarily new construction.
Any more questions, Chairman?
We'll continue, Representative.
State aid intercept, it seems like some of the states, half the states that have implemented similar provisions, there's some varying degrees of opposition to it.
Certainly, through the chair, to Representative Cott. In your packet, you'll find a more complete discussion of this issue, but in a nutshell, what that does The bond council has informed us that having that state aid intercept language in there means the difference between selling the bonds at a double A rating versus an A rating. It's assurance to the buyers of the bonds that there's less chance of default. Any funds that, what the state intercept provision says is that if there's a default by a borrower, the state agency or agencies that have control over funds that would normally have gone to that community have the ability to intercept those undesignated funds, such as revenue sharing or that type of fund, to repay the defaulted loan. It would not apply to specifically appropriated funds. They could not do that. But in the example that's listed in the packet, a $10 million bond issue over a 20-year period, the difference between a double A and an A rating is approximately $2.8 million. So there's a fair advantage to the borrowers of these funds to lower their interest rates by having that state aid intercept in there. And I might also add that in the history of this program nationwide in the last 7 years, there have been no defaults. And in our history in the state of Alaska, we've not had a single late payment. So we don't view this as a significant problem. The primary reason is that any community that defaults on this has basically ruined their own credit rating. So they're not going to be in any hurry to do it.
Any more questions from the committee? If not, I'd like to go to teleconference. We have Berta Wilson from Nome. Would
can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Verda Wilson. Shall I go ahead?
Yes, proceed.
I'm an assistant manager with Nome Joint Utilities, the municipal branch of the city of Nome, the utility branch. I'm born and raised in the Nome area, and I've lived here for 55 years, so I lived most of my life without water and sewer or any type of sanitary services like that. And I'd like to speak in favor of House Bill 401. And the reason I'm saying that is communities like mine need access to low-interest loans. And as was mentioned by Mr. Tolton, the grants are just drying up. And communities must have an alternative source of funds to provide needed public sewer and solid waste systems. And in the past, Nome Joint Utilities has taken advantage of two clean water loans at very attractive interest rates for the new sewage treatment plant and to expand the sewer force main to 60 homes that had been without pipe water and sewer. And there's still many homes in the community without pipe water and sewer. But I do ask that these loans be made available only to communities who are in need and not to state agencies. Thank you.
Yeah. Committee members have questions to the testifier? If not, thank you, Ms. Wilson. We'll go to Anchorage. Diane Bennett.
I'm here. My name is Diana Bennett. I'm the finance manager of the Anchorage Water and Wastewater Utility, a department of the municipality of Anchorage. I'm here today to speak in favor of House Bill 401 and companion Senate Bill number 207. Bills which authorize the state of Alaska to issue revenue bonds for the purpose of funding wastewater and other water quality improvement projects through the Alaska Clean Water Loan Fund. Although AWWU shares a common workforce and management team, it is actually two separate flexibility the program affords us. In the years that the Alaskan program has been in existence, ADEC has made loans totaling $53 million. There's still a tremendous need for low-cost funding throughout the state. ADEC received requests for $13 million in loans for the current fiscal year. The bill of discussion will allow what many other states have done and leverage this initial capitalization money from the federal government. Increasing the amount of funds available allows projects to be completed sooner than if we have to wait for our projects to move above the cut line. This is a good way to increase the pool of money available for necessary water quality projects without putting any other programs at risk. The burden for repayment remains with the communities requiring the funds, and is a strong incentive for them or for us to continue to make our payments. Without increasing the availability of funds, at the current request level of $13 million a year, the state's going to run out of money to loan in only 2 years. The loans are being repaid, but the repayment stream has not reached equilibrium yet, and when it does, it will still only be, I believe, $4 to $5 million, which is well below the projected need. The communities around the state need this source of low-interest money to help finance sorely needed water quality improvements. The revenue bonds will be backed, not by the full faith and credit of the state, but by the revenue coming from repayment of the loans. As you've heard, in the history of the low-interest loan program, there's never been a default, not in the entire United States. In fact, in Alaska, there's never even been a late payment. These funds will be extremely safe. The state will not be required to bail out any agency over this. You may have seen the Municipality of Anchorage memo listing some recommended changes to this bill. Utility is substantially in favor of the bill as was originally written. However, we were asked to comment on the bill with an eye to any proposed changes. This utility works closely with ADEC, and we have agreed among our two groups that this bill, with or without any or all of the suggested revisions, is extremely workable and will benefit the whole state of Alaska. I urge you to pass this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Diane Bennett. I would ask you if at all possible to, if you have testimony, written testimony, would like ask you to fax it to 465-4589 to ensure we have all of your comments here with us. Any questions from the committee? If not, we'll go to Lee Sharp in Anchorage.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Lee Sharp. Our firm has been acting as bond counsel to the state, and we've been assisting the department with some of the language that's in the bill. And I'm here only to testify if there are any questions or anything along that line that the committee would like with respect to peculiarities of bonding.
Thank you, Mr. Sharp. Questions from the committee? Representative Osterman?
One follow-up with Keith. The 20-year cycle that loans, how long ago did the loan program start? $50 million?
Representative Osterman, our program's been in place about 6 years.
When do you project? You're looking at $15 million a year max on bonding that they're talking about. $50 million being paid back over 20 years, and you've been at it 6 years, so there's got to be a time frame here when you're going to be looking at getting that $15 million stream coming back through so you won't need the bonding.
Representative Osterman, it depends on the length of the loans. Some of them are 20 years, but some of them are less than, most of them are 20 years, but some of them are less than 20 years, so to come up with a firm figure is very difficult, but just to say, for example, that we had all $80 million out there right now, and they're all 20 years, the maximum we'd be getting back is $5 million per year off of that repayment stream. Basically, there'd be some interest in there as well, but the principal would be $5 million. So that's a long ways from the demand of 15, even if we had all of the money out there and the payment cycle coming back. There's still a fairly large delta there, and that's what we're trying to decrease by selling the revenue bonds.
other questions from the committee? If not, if Anchorage is on the line, and Diane Bennett, we need it. We don't have a copy of your recommendation here for the record, and we'd appreciate it if you could fax it down to us.
I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you. And that concludes the rest of the folks on teleconference line. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify to the bill before us? If not, is there anybody else on the teleconference line that would like to make testimony or comments toward the bill before us? If not, what is the desire of the committee? Representative Elton?
Well, Mr. Chairman, this has several other committee referrals, so in light of that, I guess I'd move that we move the bill from committee with individual recommendations and attach zero fiscal notes.
Is there any objections? Hearing none, the bill is moved out of the committee.
I didn't know Keith that he
was. I expect to pay some back in three, but they were 20-year loans, but paid them back early.
The next bill before us is House Bill 400, if I have my numbers right. Welfare reform, and in your packets is a copy of the bill, the governor's transmittal letter, and numerous fiscal notes from affected agencies. And we have presenting the bill Deputy Commissioner Jay Livey from the Hess Department. We also have, understand, Jim Nordland, Public Assistance Director, and Kurt Loomis from Public Assistance also present for the testimony. With that, welcome, Mr. Livey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Excuse me, for the record, I'm Jay Livey, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Health and Social Services. First of all, thank you very much for scheduling this legislation. Our purpose here today is to provide the committee with both an overview of the legislation as well as the progress of what's going on with regard to health care reform, or welfare reform, rather, in D.C. The issues seem to be linked. I want to talk about some of the D.C. and changes in the overview. And then Jim can give you a summary of more detail on the legislation itself. Welfare reform has been an issue back in D.C. now for, as we know, for several months. And there seem to be two major issues that I think are worth keeping in mind with regard to what's going on back in D.C. The major change is the movement from changing AFDC from an entitlement program to a block grant. Historically, AFDC has been a joint federal-state partnership in which the federal government matches state expenditures. So if populations increase and there are more welfare recipients, if the economy turns down so there are more welfare recipients, then the federal government would participate with the state in helping to fund those additional costs to help those folks maintain a safety net. With block grants, that is not necessarily the case. The block grant amount and the money that would come to the state to pay for AFDC would be based on a prior expenditure year, in our case probably 1994. And if the cost of AFDC goes up in the future, then it leaves the state with a choice of putting in additional state funds or making other changes in the program. That's a major change in how this program is operated. I think the second major theme that's going on back in D.C. that we need to keep in mind is that we're not just, when we say welfare reform, we don't just mean the AFDC program. because in Congress, welfare reform means a lot of things. It includes changes to child support programs, for example. It includes changes to food stamps and other nutritional programs. It includes changes to child care. It includes changes to child welfare and the Medicaid programs. In addition, there are bills in Congress that would combine and block grant all the employment and training money that currently comes to the state. So when we talk about welfare reform on a federal level, we mean comprehensive changes in a lot of programs that are interactive and have effects on each other. So what's happening in D.C. with regard to welfare reform? Well, there was a standalone welfare reform bill that passed both the House and the Senate, and that bill was vetoed by the President. In addition, there are welfare reform proposals that are currently under negotiation in the Budget Reconciliation Act. Recently, the National Governors Association met in D.C., and they came up with a blueprint regarding what they believe should go into welfare reform. There are congressional hearings scheduled on those provisions over the next couple of weeks. And so I think that even though we're all surprised that welfare reform hasn't happened yet on a federal level, I think there's still a good possibility that something will happen this year in this next Congress. The ambiguity of not having federal welfare reform, I think, has made all of our jobs a little bit more difficult. We believe that regardless of what happens in D.C., that reform should go forward. And if Congress and the President get together on reform, then the bill that you have before you provides a framework within which we can work. If Congress and the President don't get together, the governor's bill offers a way of applying for waivers that will implement as much of the provisions of the bill as possible. So we think that regardless of what happens in D.C., that this bill should move forward, and we should move on with welfare reform. With that brief overview, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn over to Jim Nordland to talk more specifically about the provisions of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Nordland. Yeah. Good. Before we proceed, Representative Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Before we make the switch over and start looking at the details, Commissioner, you, under the first major theme that you talked about, you talked about that if costs go up, it's not necessarily true that federal support will go up and that the states will either have to reduce services or chip in more money. But one of the concerns that I have is that there is no protection either from future Congresses. If the block grant level is X 1 year, that doesn't necessarily mean that it won't be Y the next year, right? So that it would force states to also pick up if funding is reduced by a future Congress.
Through Chair, Representative Elton, that's correct. The bill is written so that the block grant amount that we would receive in 94 would essentially be appropriated to the state every year for 5 years, but of course Congress could come back and change that action at any time.
I would note that that's exactly what we've done to municipalities under revenue sharing municipal assistance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jim Nordland. I'm the Director of the Division of Public Assistance. And I want to thank you for scheduling the bill. We have been working on this legislation for quite a long time and are finally able to present it to the legislature on the first day of the session. The process that we went through in arriving at this legislation was really quite thorough. First of all, this bill is not the product of only our agency. It is a product of several agencies in state government, namely the Departments of Labor, Law, Community and Regional Affairs, Education, Administration, Revenue, Commerce, as well as our own department, of course, and AHFC and the new AHRIC. There's been an interagency task force that had been meeting over the summer and fall to put together some of the tenets in this legislation, and some of the work of that interagency group is here in this report that I have in front of me. Also, the bill is a product of the governor's blueprint for welfare reform, which was released about a year ago on May 1st of 95. And most of the principles and philosophy behind our legislation is contained in this report, which you might want to refer to later. Also, the legislation was based on a series of meetings that was community meetings that were held over the late summer and fall. These meetings were funded by the legislature last year, and we met in 14 areas around the state. Actually, I have copies so I can pass out, Tom, if you want. And we solicited the comments of Alaskans to see exactly what kind of a welfare system they would like to see, given the new flexibility the federal government is due to give to us in the construction of our own welfare program. And finally, the legislation is based upon legislation that was introduced last year, both in the Senate and the House, primarily by Senator Green and Representative Hanley, and the governor's bill last year. So we did do a thorough review. I want to emphasize that the legislation that's before you today is one element of the plan. We also have changes in the budget, as well as we're making administrative changes in the agency that are not dependent upon either the budget or this particular legislation, but that we feel that we can do as an administrative agency to forward the cause of welfare reform. There are some primary principles I want to let you know that went into the thinking in our approach to welfare reform. And the four major ones are, number one, welfare as a permanent solution for individuals who find themselves in desperate straits or of low income and need to support their family. The fact that welfare is no longer going to be a permanent solution for them, we want to make sure that the AFDC in the future becomes a temporary assistance to families in need, and that that in exchange for that, we will continue to maintain a safety net for low-income individuals. We want to emphasize work, make sure that work is heavily, basically that work is required in order to receive benefits, that benefits are limited, that they don't last forever, and finally, that in order to receive assistance from the state, that there's a measure of responsibility that's required on the part of recipients as well as the state to make sure that individuals who receive welfare are able to move successfully off of public assistance and into the workforce. I want to touch briefly, I know that we're here to talk about the bill, but I did want to touch briefly upon some important budget changes that we have in the operating budget that forward the cause of welfare reform. And what we are asking for in this year's budget is a reinvestment of saved benefit dollars. This year, we have seen a drop in the caseload for a number of reasons, one of which I think are some of the early successes that we've seen with our welfare reform efforts. We've seen a drop in the caseload. What we're asking for is for a reinvestment of those dollars that have been saved due to the drop in caseload into job training and to child care. Two essential elements, two things that are essential in order to be successful with welfare reform. I also want to touch briefly upon some of the administrative changes that we're making. We are, as an agency, trying to change the culture of the welfare office, one from which we have been in the past simply determining eligibility and issuing benefits, to one in which our caseworkers work with clients to develop a self-sufficiency plan and to help them through the necessary steps so that they can become self-sufficient. We're co-locating our agency with the Department of Labor's Employment Security at various locations around the state, both for programmatic reasons as well as symbolic reasons to recipients, in that when they go into apply for welfare benefits, they're going to be basically going into the employment office and need to take the steps necessary for them to become employable as well. That's sort of the background of the overall plan, the governor's welfare reform plan. The bill itself, the one in front of you today, House Bill 400, is a comprehensive redesign of what is currently the AFDC program. It focuses on work and self-sufficiency, and well as provides the tools for individuals so that they can move from welfare into the workforce. The bill repeals the AFDC and the jobs program, completely wipes those programs off the books, and starts all over again with a new program that we have called the Alaska Family Independence Program. And the implementation of this program is for the most part takes into is based upon what we anticipate to be changes in federal law. As Jay mentioned, if the federal law does not change and does not allow us to implement this program through a sweeping change as we have envisioned in this bill, there are provisions in this legislation that will allow the department to go forward and apply for waivers so we can implement as much as of the welfare reform changes as we can through the waiver process. The bill, as I mentioned, establishes limits on assistance, and I want to give you some examples of the way we're going to go about that. Before I mention that, I might add that the legislation is pretty broadly constructed. Many of the things that we actually plan to do will be done through regulation, and you can get almost a better idea of how the program will operate if you read the fiscal note as opposed to reading the bill itself. So some of the things I'm going to mention are apparent as you read the fiscal note, and some of them are apparent as you read the bill. First of all, regarding limits on benefits, we are going to carry forward what looks to be a requirement from the federal government that there'll be a 60-month lifetime limit on benefits. That's a 5-year limit, and we carry that forward in this legislation. Secondly, we anticipate basing payment levels on household expenses. Currently, we pay benefits essentially the same for two families, regardless of what their personal living expenses are or their family living expenses. One of the biggest determinants of that, of course, is how our housing costs. We'll pay the same benefit currently to a family that has free rent or subsidized rent as we pay benefits to a family who has to pay maybe $700 or $800 a month. What we want to do there is to equalize those benefits, basically reduce benefits to those families that receive a free or subsidized housing. That results in about a $2 million savings to the budget. What we are asking for in the fiscal note is a realignment of those benefit savings into increasing the earned income disregard. The earned income disregard is basically the amount of money that recipients are allowed to keep, the amount of earned income that recipients are allowed to keep before their benefits are reduced. If we increase that earned income disregard, it's a further incentive for recipients to take a job as opposed to staying on public assistance. There are a number of provisions in this legislation in which we provide incentives for individuals to go to work as opposed to staying on public assistance. We require teens to live at home and to finish their high school education or their GED in order to receive these benefits. We give a higher priority to one-parent families as opposed to two-parent families. And we establish disqualifications or sanctions for individuals who refuse to take a job when it's available to them, assuming that that adequate child care is available to them and that they're adequately trained for that employment. Speaking of employment, there is a heavy emphasis in this legislation on work and job development. We have a provision. It is the intention of the governor and the department to require all recipients to be working or to be in work or a work-related activity within 2 years of when they apply for benefits or when they first receive benefits. Require all families to adhere to a self-sufficiency plan. This will be a plan that's developed between our caseworkers in our individual offices around the state and the family. They would outline a series of steps, maybe over a period of 2 or 3 years, that the family would have to go through in order for them to move off of public assistance and into employment. We, as I mentioned, increased the earned income disregard so that there's more incentive to work. We get rid of some ridiculous federal, currently federal regulations that are disincentives to work. One of those is the 100-hour rule that says that any individual who works more than 100 hours a month is no longer eligible for the program. That's widely held as a very counterproductive rule that most states are doing away with either under their waiver programs or under their own state law. We currently, right now, the recipients are only allowed to have a car that's valued at $1,500, and in many cases that precludes them from having adequate transportation to go to work so they can take a job. We will eliminate that provision for one car that's owned by that family. We have special incentives for the development of self-employment for recipients if they're so suited. We expand opportunities for community work service through nonprofits. We provide for, as I mentioned, the integration of public assistance and the employment services offices around the state. And we continue to coordinate with the new Alaska Human Resources Investment Council in terms of looking out for those job opportunities that exist now, will hopefully exist in the future for welfare recipients. We don't want to forget also that the primary reason why AFDC exists in the first place and why we still want to make sure that there continues to be a cash assistance program for families, and that is that there are still poor people in the state with families, that children need to be protected when they're in that situation. And so with this bill continues to maintain a safety net for low-income individuals with children. What we have done in this legislation is painstakingly avoided across-the-board benefit cuts. There are benefit cuts in this legislation, as I mentioned, for certain individuals in certain circumstances. We look at those as surgical benefit cuts, those kinds of cuts that will increase the incentives for individuals to go to work, as well as benefit cuts that bring some equity across those families who are currently receiving AFDC. But the point is that we object to across-the-board benefit cuts, and this bill does not have that in it. We provide services to teen parents to assure that they have safe homes. We are requiring that they live at home or live in a supervised, safe living environment, and we want to make sure that since there, that requirement is going to be in law, that the department is able to adequately assure that those teens will be living in a safe living environment. We work to help establish a better cooperation and communication between food banks and soup kitchens in the state. Commissioner Perdue has taken the lead in establishing a food coalition, which is a group of individuals who have been meeting for the last several months around the state to make sure that the state has an integrated nutritional program for low-income people in the state. And finally, the bill envisions more community involvement in the administration of what is currently the AFDC program. The AFDC program right now, as well as most of the programs that the Division of Public Assistance operates, is a state-to-client relationship. We don't do a lot of grants. We maintain offices in 12 locations around the state and have about 450 employees. And our division directly provides services to clients. We envision in the future, under welfare reform and under the flexibility that's allowed from welfare reform, that local communities, be it Native organizations or local nonprofits or municipalities, could take over parts of what our division is currently administering. And this bill gives the grant authority to the department to do that. I did mention the fact that we anticipate providing, we're working with Native organizations in the administration of under a new welfare reform program. This has come primarily from the federal government. Right now, envisioned in the federal law, that if there is a bill that passes and is signed by the president, there's little doubt that there will be a Native set-aside provision in that legislation that will allow Native organizations to contract directly with the federal government for provision of what is currently the AFDC program. The administration is in support of that, and there is language in this bill that asks the department to coordinate with Native organizations and cooperate with Native organizations as they work with the federal government in establishing their own programs. I know that there's probably a number of folks here online, and there's folks in the audience here from Native organizations who would like to be able to testify on that provision. And we are working hand in hand with them to make sure that we have a workable program coordinated between the state and Native organizations in the future. And Jay just showed me one note. I certainly don't want to forget to mention that child support is a big part of this bill. Currently, as you're probably well aware, the state treasury pays for the support of, in many cases, children that whose other parent are not providing for currently. And what this bill does is increase the tools available to the Division of Child Support Enforcement to collect child support payments from child support obligors. The language in this bill is identical to the language that passed the legislature last year in regards to the child support. And it looks like the language in here uses the possible withholding of individuals' occupational or driver's licenses in lieu of their child support payments. That language will be required by the federal government under the welfare reform proposals that are currently being considered by the Congress. So with that, Mr. Chairman, that's a brief overview of the bill. There is a section-by-section analysis in the legislation that we could go over if you'd like, but for now, maybe I'll just turn it back to you, Mr. Chairman, and see if there's any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Nordland. A couple questions. You mentioned that the possibility of block grants going to state of Alaska and some will divert over to the Native community. Will that decrease the number of personnel in Division of Public Assistance in your offices?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The correct way I think of portraying that relationship is the monies that would come from the federal government wouldn't go to the state; they would go directly to the Native organization. It would be a direct federal Native relationship for the federal share of that money. To answer your question, there probably will be some effect on the number of employees that we have in our division. It's hard to determine that right now, though, because currently, we also administer the food stamp program as well as the adult public assistance programs, and our staff would still need to be doing eligibility for those programs, while the Native organizations would be doing eligibility for the AFDC program. So we need to work with Native organizations to make sure that we're providing this as efficiently as possible, and we anticipate that if we give up not only the benefit dollars that the state is currently administering to Native organizations, as well as some of the administrative dollars to those Native organizations, that we would see a reduction in our staff. It's too difficult to quantify it right now.
Thank you. I voted for a measure that passed the House last session, and What's the difference between this bill and the one that passed the House? But you mentioned child support, the similarities. The child support was similar to the one that passed the House, and mm-hmm. there was changes on the other side.
Yeah.
Highlights if possible.
Sure, briefly. Last year's legislation was based upon current law in Alaska. The way we wanted to achieve welfare reform was through waivers in the federal law. This that was a, which you might say, much more piecemeal or portioned out approach to welfare reform. Last year's legislation went. This year's legislation is a sweeping change. It's comprehensive change. We are wiping off, as I mentioned earlier, wiping clean the current AFDC and JAWS program statutes and starting all over. We are doing this anticipation of federal welfare reform. Last year's legislation was based upon existing federal and state law. So it is, in a word, Mr. Chairman, it's a comprehensive change as opposed to a piecemeal change that was envisioned last year.
And making comparisons again, a five-year guideline was used in the last session bill. Is there a difference between your five-year timeline?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, that's a good question, and I'm glad I got a chance to clarify that. Last year's legislation would have been signed by the governor, except for one provision, and that was the five-year provision in last year's legislation. And whether it was intentional or not, the way that the AG's office read that legislation is that the five-year limit would have kicked in for individuals starting at birth. In other words, an individual who was a child and a beneficiary of the AFDC program who had been receiving benefits for 5 years would never be eligible for AFDC again for the rest of their lives. In other words, if they became an adult, found themselves in a problem, for a temporary problem even, that they would not be eligible for AFDC. The governor felt that was exceptionally harmful to children, and with some regret had to veto an otherwise good piece of legislation because of that provision in there that dealt with a five-year limit.
Thank you. One last question. The Alaska Family Independence Program is in the title of the bill. What is the difference between AFDC and the JOBS program that Alaska Family Independence Program is replacing?
Mr. Chairman, the reason that we don't identify the JAWS program anymore is not, I want to be clear about this, is not because we don't consider the JAWS program to be important. In fact, what we envision the future program being is our whole agency almost is the JAWS program. Currently, right now, the JAWS program deals with about 20% of our caseload and has a number of tools that's envisioned in this bill in terms of, you know, sanctions for individuals if they don't go to work, as well as providing the tools for individuals, the transitional services and those kinds of tools that enable individuals to go to work. We're not looking at that anymore for just a segment of the caseload, but we want the entire AFDC program to become like the JAWS program. And to make sure that it is clear that the AFDC program as we know it in the past is no longer exists, we thought it would be appropriate to rename the program. It's renamed on the federal level, and we thought it would be appropriate to rename it also on the state level.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Elton?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm halfway comforted, I guess, on the five-year limit. I mean, you described what the bill did last year that was onerous. I mean, am I to assume then that the five-year limit doesn't kick in until you reach the age of majority, or so that's when the clock begins ticking? I guess the question that I have is, I mean, if a person, a parent, has been in the program from the age of 21 to 26, I mean, what happens to the kids in that family once the parent is kicked out? And what percentage of your client base do you assume would get kicked out by a five-year limit?
Representative Elton, through the chair, just to be clear, what's envisioned under the federal law, which we're carrying through in this legislation, is that that the entire family would be, after 5 years, after 60 months of receiving benefits, would be ineligible to receive benefits again. The child in that family, once they had a family, and it basically establishes a new case, would be eligible. But the children, as well as the adults, would be cut off of benefits after 60 months. And what was the other? I'm sorry. What was
well, I mean, I guess, I guess the concern that I have is that we've got a program then that kicks a child out for the failure of a parent to matriculate from the program, whatever the structure of the program would be. I mean, the structure of the bill that's being presented here, I'm assuming, is anticipating the federal requirement that there is a 60-month limit. There's nothing the state can do about that.
Mr. Chairman, we don't know exactly what the state could do about that. We don't know where we're going to be necessarily in 5 years once this provision kicks in. Let me just say it is a great concern to this administration what happens to individual families that go over the 60-month limit. It is our goal to not allow that to happen, that we need to bring as many forces to bear as we can to make sure that those individuals are given every opportunity to move into the workforce as possible. I should mention that there is currently either a 15 or 20% exemption, depending on which version of the federal welfare reform you look at, that we anticipate that it'll probably be 20. That's what the National Governors Association has suggested. 20% of the caseload would be exempt from the 60-month limit, and those individuals who would be exempt presumably would be folks who are disabled and unable to work, or individuals who live in chronically high unemployment areas where there is no hope of getting work. But this continues to be a source of concern to us, and as we develop our plan, we will be mindful of that. I think it just puts much more emphasis, though, on the importance of preparing individuals to move into the workforce, providing the necessary child care so they can leave the home and either go through job training or take a job, as well as providing the job training that's necessary to give them a reasonable chance of holding down a job.
Mr. Chairman, if I might add to that, we do have, Jim's right that what it does is it puts a lot more responsibility on both, of course, on both the family as well as the department. And one of the, if you look through the fiscal note on the bill and in conjunction with our budget, what we've proposed there is to take some savings from caseload reductions and continually reinvest those savings into job training and child care and adult basic education and some of those other areas that we think we need to spend some money on so that we create the opportunity so people can work their way off the program.
Just before we continue on, please write your questions down, but I'd like to give the teleconference community an opportunity to speak to this bill. We'll have ample time and opportunity to get at these folks before us, but to give these folks online, I'd like to recognize, go to Kodiak, Carol Yakish from Canada. Please state your name, address, telephone number, affiliation, if any.
Hey, my name is Carol Yakish. I'm a social worker with Kodiak Area Native Association at 402 Center Avenue in Kodiak. And I guess I've got a few concerns, mainly because I do work with the BIA General Assistance Program for the Native Villages on Kodiak Island. I don't do it for the city of Kodiak, but I do it for the villages. One of the concerns I have in not knowing at this point whether or not BIA General Assistance Programs are going to continue, how they're going to fit into the state block grant areas, and whether or not CANA, as one of the 12 organizations listed, would or would not take on the responsibility of what we know now as the AFDC program. I think that the impact on the villages that we deal with is going to be great. I think that the village participants in either program, whether it be AFDC by the state
Carol, do you have any more comments to the bill before us? Committee members have questions? If not, we'll go on to Fairbanks. Louise Charles?
Good afternoon. My name is Louise Charles, and I administer the Job Opportunities and Basic Skills Program for Canada Peace Congress, and I've been in this position for 4 years. I was born and raised in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta area, an area of the state with the highest number of welfare recipients, highest unemployment rate, and a lack of even basic services such as water and sewer systems. I now live and work in the Doyon region, which ranks number 2 in these same areas. I have worked in several social service capacities, and I'm very well aware of the barriers and problems that rural Native people face. I want to inform you what some of those barriers are and what some of the tribal solutions might look like. My interest in presenting testimony today is to state my favor of House Bill 400, the Governor's Welfare Reform Bill, and that this legislation reflects fairness to urban and rural welfare recipients alike. And I would like to enlighten you about some of the obstacles that tribal grantees face in providing welfare to work programs. And I would also like you to understand some of the successes that the jobs program, the tribal, especially the tribal jobs program, have achieved. For the TCC jobs program here in Fairbanks, participation by AFBC clients has increased from 37 clients in 1971 to 107 clients served this last, in 1991, excuse me, to 107 served this last quarter from October to December 1995. There, during the same quarter, 25 village clients were served in 1995. In 1991, there were no village clients served. With the funding shortfalls, I believe, I know that we have reached the maximum number that can be served by our federal grant, and we will utilize all of our child care funds for this fiscal year by June 30th, 1996. Our federal grant for this year is $109,466, which is 75% of the total we should receive if we get past the March 16th continuing resolution next deadline, I guess. Our jobs child care grant for this FY96 is $150,000. It's the same as last year. We understand that this is the maximum we'll be able to get. Child care funds in the state have maxed out, as many of us know. Our largest basic jobs grant was $185,000 for FY95. With these funds, we are charged with serving 42 villages in the Doyon region, plus Fairbanks, and 8 villages on the Arctic, in the Arctic Slope region. That area encompasses 323,000 square miles from Anvik in southwest Alaska to Eagle, which is near the Canadian border, and from McGrath on the Yukon-Kuskokwim River in central Alaska to Barrow on the northern coast of Alaska. It is impossible to serve all of the eligible clients with our current funding. With very careful fiscal management and coordination of efforts with other existing programs, we are trying our best. And we are succeeding in many instances. The governor's plan includes an allocation of $944,000 for tribal jobs programs. Tribal grantees do need this funding to be able to, so that we are able to continue assistance, provide assistance, and to increase services so that we can help more people to exit the jobs program to become successfully and gainfully employed. Some of the ways that the jobs program has realized successes is that we, and I'm speaking for PCC jobs, but I know it's true for many of the tribal Alaska and the Adult Learning Programs of Alaska. We work in cooperation with the University of Alaska Fairbanks Campus and Tamanau Valley Campus, and distance delivery is also provided through the Interior Campus and through the Kuskokwim University Campus in Bethel. Many of our clients that utilize these programs must take developmental or adult-based education courses prior to gaining the skills and education they need to get into a job that would pay them well enough to become self-supporting. We've had successful on-the-job training contracts that has exited clients into permanent employment. Some of those training contracts have been with village entities. We've worked with local employers. We've worked with the University of Alaska, and we've also had a client even hired by the state of Alaska this past fall. And that was our first of many. This past fall, with a collaboration grant between TCC Jobs and the TCC Home Healthcare Program, the Older Persons Action Group, and the state of Alaska, we were able to train and employ 9 AFPC recipients from rural villages in the Doyon region as certified nurses' aides. These aides came in to Fairbanks for a 3-week intensive training course. After they completed their training, they went back to the village and were employed by the Home Healthcare Program. And all of those clients are now self-supporting and off of the AFPC roles. We are endeavoring at this time to work out a similar training program with Fairbanks Memorial Hospital here in Fairbanks for a spring training. We don't have enough money to train as many clients that could go to work here in Fairbanks, but we hope to train at least 4 or 5. We think that this type of collaboration effort needs to take place more often in local areas, and especially with existing village entities such as with the schools, Head Start, clinics, and private enterprise, so that welfare reform will be successful at the village level. And I've heard a lot of discussion about what's happening or not happening in the urban areas. And I think that we need to look for solutions at the rural areas and the village levels. It's absolutely necessary for us to look to solutions at that level for the state and for tribal entities who are operating, who are administering our own programs. We've worked successfully, with the teen parenting program at Hutchinson Career Center and at the Howard Luke High School and some of the other local high schools here in Fairbanks. Served pregnant or parenting teens. We have several clients who have taken vocational training at Hutchinson Career Center as a job corps.
Ms. Charles, I'd have to interject here and ask you to please summarize your comments, and if you have testimony to submit, please send them to us or to the LIE office, and they'll forward your testimony to us. Please summarize your comments.
Okay. I think that the jobs program works and that we need to continue with funding for the jobs program. And if there are going to be block grants, if their block grant concept is going to come to the state, it'll be necessary to have formal coordination and collaboration between state and federal programs and the tribal programs. And that we need to look to the local solutions that will be fair and accessible to everyone. And I will forward written testimony to your committee and to the state offices. And if anyone has any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you very much, Ms. Charles. We've got 4 other people that would like to testify on, and we'll give you 3 minutes apiece. We have in Anchorage, Angela Salerno.
Hospital 400. I would like
for childcare for those who are in school or for those who go into work. Additionally, we support provisions which will increase child support collections and also provisions to offer pregnancy prevention assistance to recipients. I want to take this opportunity as well to commend the department on the work that they have done in responding to the federal mandate for welfare reform. They did a great deal of good work in preparing this plan, reaching out to the communities of Alaska. They worked very hard to include both urban and rural citizens in the process, the long planning process that they went through. I want to commend the commissioner, also Jim Nordland and his staff. And I think that the committee can be sure, because of this process, that this is the plan that Alaskan citizens will support. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Salerno. We have also Glenn Straube.
I'm not here to testify, just to answer any questions you might have about child support.
Thank you. We'll go to Delta Junction, and there's a Gene Otenstor.
Yeah, you got it pretty close. Not sure, but I'm sure it's good enough. How much federal funding will you receive by passing this bill and others like it, such as domestic violence?
Yes, Gene, please state your name.
My name is
address,
Gene
telephone number for the record, please.
My name is Gene Ostrayer. I'm from Delta Junction here, of course. I'm speaking in regards of a victim of states and guardians of family rights and concerned citizens. So I ask you again, how much federal funding does the state receive by passing this bill and others like it, such as domestic violence bill? Do you have any idea?
I certainly don't. Mr. Nordland, you have a response to the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill has no direct effect on the amount of federal funding we receive. It is an anticipation of a federal block grant that we'll receive. The block grant amount is likely to be the amount of money that we received for AFDC jobs, for the AFDC program, the jobs program, as well as the AFDC administration in the fiscal year 94. Which is currently less than what we currently receive. So this bill is written with the vision, envisioning fewer federal dollars available to the state for the administration of these programs.
Thank you, Mr. Nordland. Do you have any more comments?
Yes, I do. This bill and others like it is geared to strip the families of wealth and freedom and put us under the whips of slavery. All these bills are geared for federal funding or bounty and control on we the people. This bill not only attacks the Constitution, Bill of Rights, and Magna Carta, this is an all-out attack on the backbone of our country, the family. Anyone that would vote for this bill or any like it is committing treason. A better plan of attack for welfare reform would be to put the recipients to work while they're on welfare, such as things like WPA or things like that, jobs that ain't very nice. If they were physically capable, this would not only save money, but would also put some desire by the recipients to get off of welfare. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ottenstra. We also have Jeannie Phibbs there at the Delta Junction.
Yes,